This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Introducing Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth, a podcast offered by the journal Psychological Perspectives, a quarterly journal of Jungian thought. Psychological Perspectives is a beautiful journal whose mission is to promote greater consciousness by honoring and amplifying the psychology of C.G. Jung. The journal has been published since 1970, sponsored by the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles. Jung said, "In the same way that the body needs food, and not just any kind of food, but only that which suits it, the psyche needs to know the meaning of its existence. Not just any meaning, but the meaning of those images and ideas which reflect its nature and which originate in the unconscious." Jung was fascinated by every aspect of the psyche and its relationship with the outer world. That fascination led him to explore not only dreams and fantasies, but also mythology and fairy tales, philosophy and fiction, as well as the leading science of his day, from anthropology to nuclear physics. Anything that touched on the psyche was his field of interest, and ours as well. Psychological Perspectives publishes a wide range of articles, from depth psychology to science, from politics to philosophy, as well as fiction, poetry, and current book, video, and film reviews. Each issue is a feast, not only for the mind, but for the eye as well, filled with art that flows from the cover through the articles. On our new Jungian Perspectives podcast, we choose an article once a month from the journal archives and invite the author to speak with us more intimately and in depth. We offer you the chance to explore with us what relevance and meaning the Jungian perspective might have for your personal life and our collective life today. Welcome to Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth.
I'm Thomas Elsner, Jungian analyst and an editor at the journal Psychological Perspectives, where we get to know and go deeper in with the authors who contribute articles, poetry, and art to Psychological Perspectives, a quarterly journal of Jungian thought. This podcast is co-sponsored by the Los Angeles Jung Institute and the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California, and funded by the generous donations of the Earthways Foundation, devoted to promoting sustainable vision and action for the earth and humanity, a vision for the future that all living things can share. We're privileged to have with us, and I can say definitively, our greatest and most interesting guest ever on this podcast, also our very first guest, James Driscoll. James is the author of King Lear, Answer to Job, The Archetypes of Godhead, which can be found in the issue of Psychological Perspectives entitled Divine Darkness, which is volume 66, Issue 3 from 2023. I have the great privilege today of exploring this fascinating article with the author himself. And I'd like to introduce him to all of us. James Driscoll has a PhD in English literature and Shakespeare. He has applied Jungian psychology to literature, philosophy, and social issues. His published books are Identity in Shakespearean Drama, 1983, The Unfolding God of Jung and Milton, Shakespeare and Jung, The God in Time, Shakespeare's Identities, How AIDS Activists Challenged America, Jung's Cartography of the Psyche, The Devil and Dr. Fauci, and Carl versus Carl, Jung and Marx, Two Icons for Our Age. So quite the prolific author. Also, interestingly, James became prominent in the movement to speed FDA approval for AIDS and cancer drugs in the 1990s. How AIDS Activists Challenged America reviews his career as an AIDS, LGBTQ, and FDA reform activist. So quite the fascinating background, both with work on the ground and this interest in Shakespeare and Jung. And I'm hoping in the interview we'll get to hear how those two might go together. Before we get to know James, however, and hear from him directly, I would like to offer some of my thoughts, some background behind why we invited James and where we might go today in our conversation. Yuval Noah Harari, who's a professor in the Department of History at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and as many people might know, the best-selling author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, was discussing in a recent interview the negative, dark effects of artificial intelligence. And in that interview, Harari gives an answer to the question of what we might do to ameliorate the dark side of AI. For us to be okay, Harari suggests, we will have to spend as much time and money on developing our consciousness as we do on developing our machines. What might it mean, however, to develop the full potential of our own minds? How do we do that? When it comes to the phenomenology of developing our own minds and our own consciousness, I want to suggest that we can learn much from literature, myth, and dream, from the poets and the psychologists, and little from the technically skilled elite. Now, James, as we've seen, has written extensively on Jung, Shakespeare, and Milton. In his article that we're discussing today, tracks the development of our minds in his article, King Lear, Answer to Job, The Archetypes of Godhead. The characters of Lear and Job develop in parallel with the development of the Western God image as distinct from the paradigms of the Industrial Revolution. In other words, as we'll get into today, the transformation and evolution of consciousness requires more than good intentions, money, and time. It requires chaos and the abject black, darkness experienced to the utmost degree. Lear, James writes, returns both mad and supremely aware. He is a man rent, beaten, and shattered, hallowing his irrepressible will to become more conscious and more whole, unquote. Driscoll's essay seems to me a tour de force expression of what he calls the terrible authenticity of the struggle to attain human consciousness and a more humane consciousness through an encounter with the dark side of God understood as injustice, death, suffering, time, and evil, in which tragedy and evil are essential to wholeness in both man and the deity. The secret here, Driscoll's essay suggests, is a secret the modern mind is loath to confront. In James's own words, pride tells us we are everything, necessity shows us we are nothing. In our nothingness, we can discover the truth about ourselves and compassion for others. So there's a lot there to get into today and to expand upon. What I'd like to do first is just say, welcome, James. Thank you for appearing on this podcast. And it's a real pleasure to be able to delve into these subjects with you today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for that superb introduction, Tom.
Well, where I'd like to start, before we dig into King Lear itself, and Answer to Job, and what you mean by the Godhead, and how those all go together, I thought we might say something in general about the visionary artist. You write, for instance, that King Lear is a prime example of the visionary artist speaking from and for his unconscious psyche and the collective unconscious of our Western civilization. So I was wondering, maybe you could say something about how you see Shakespeare as a visionary artist, Jung's idea of visionary art, you know, and how that might relate to the subject we're going to dig into here today.
Well, Shakespeare is interesting, seen as a visionary artist, because he is, of course, the supreme poet and dramatist, somebody who was good at absolutely everything. He's good at realism, naturalism, comedy, tragedy, romance, and he is also good at visionary, supreme at visionary art, because I look upon King Lear as the supreme example in Western literature of visionary art. And why is it that? Because it's a vision of our particular, of the archetypes that operate within and form our particular conception of, conception isn't the right word, the symbol, the figure, they form the Godhead. And that's probably the supreme object for any kind of visionary art within a particular civilization, and each civilization has its own set of archetypes that form its Godhead. And in my view, the incisive, most provocative view and the clearest view of the archetypes of our Godhead, I mean the actual Godhead, not the orthodox theories about the Godhead, but the actual archetypes, archetypal dynamism that work through our civilization and through our ideas on religion, the two best places to go to find that is in literature, it's King Lear. And in psychology and philosophy, it is Carl Jung, particularly in answer to Job, although the questions of the nature of the Godhead was something that he dealt with massively in the last fourth of his life. And it runs through the alchemical writings and many, many letters and other pieces that he wrote, mostly since he had the heart attack. And when was it, Tom? Was it 1946?
I think 44. He had two, 46 and 44.
Oh, 44. Okay. Well, that was a year after I was born. So I should remember. But I think that to best understand Answer to Job, it's very, very useful to read it along with King Lear and vice versa. To understand what Shakespeare is saying in King Lear, read Answer to Job. They both deal with the same archetypes, the same themes, and convey the same wisdom, I would say.
Interesting, James. Really, we're going to unpack that. There's a lot in there. What's happening in King Lear, what's happening in Answer to Job, how they relate, how they're talking about something that's maybe the same thing in terms of what you call the Godhead or the God image, I guess, or the guiding collective spirit of a civilization and its transformations. Very, very interesting. Before we get into King Lear, and I want to get into King Lear specifically to start, I'll quote back to you something from your article, which I thought was a very powerful paragraph here. You say, King Lear is the paramount work of our greatest dramatist and poet of all time at the height of his powers. Only Genesis and the Book of Job and the Gospels match its revelation of the archetypes shaping the character of the supreme autonomous collective spirit, the guiding self of Western civilization, which you also call the Godhead. However, nothing in the Bible or anywhere else rivals King Lear's overwhelming emotional impact, sheer artistic genius, and terrible authenticity. Wow, that's a mouthful. That's a lot. Before we get into why the power of King Lear, why the power of Answer to Job, maybe you could give for us a synopsis in a way, a plot summary for those who don't remember King Lear or haven't read it in a long time or maybe have never read it. Just if you don't mind, a quick breakdown, as difficult as that is to ask for about such a monumental work, of what happens in King Lear.
Okay, it begins with Lear, who is first portrayed as a figure, very arbitrary, very willful king and father, very similar to the Yahweh we see in the Book of Job. And he decides in old age to divide his kingdom, and he asks his three daughters to tell him which of them loves him most, so that he may decide which parcel to give to them. And the first two daughters, Gunnel and Regan, flatter him totally over the top. And the third daughter, Cordelia, who is the youngest and his favorite, she refuses to flatter. She says she loves him as is her duty as a daughter. And he asked for more. Can't you say more? And she said, if I love my father all, how can I give myself to a husband? And she refuses to say more. He says, so young and so, I've forgotten the word, perverse, so willful. And she says, so young and untrue. And he casts her out, gives her nothing, and goes with the two evil daughters. Well, things go badly quickly with the evil daughters. They wind up throwing him out. Goneril, the eldest, she throws him out into a heath in a storm with his fool. And he becomes a figure like Job. Instead of talking like Yahweh, he's now talking like Job, referring to even to boils and referring to Job himself, identifying with Job. But he learns out there. He learns about suffering. He learns, begins to learn about the flaws.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
So his own previous nature as this willful, arbitrary, Yahweh-like king, he's also has the fool with him who represents the child archetype. And he learns from the fool. But the play continues with, there's a subplot of Gloucester, one of the earls of the kingdom, and his two sons, one who is evil, a Machiavelli-type manipulator. The other one is the good son. And their story parallels in a realistic mode what Lear is doing in a much more symbolic level. At the end, there's the battle. The side of the evil daughters prevails. Lear is united with Cordelia, and he recognizes at that point all of his sins and all of his flaws, and he says she has great cause not to love him. She says, no cause, no cause. And they're reunited. It becomes clear that she is like a Christ figure. Only at the symbolic level, Lear is like a Christ figure at more of a realistic level, because all of the suffering, there's all sorts of crucifixion imagery in the play, and it all applies to Lear. Lear is being crucified. It's the crucifixion. We see the crucifixion of Yahweh portrays in the play, not literally, but more symbolically through the imagery. And Cordelia represents Christ at a symbolic level, just as Lear represents Christ at that point in the play at a naturalistic level, the level of the suffering Christ. And in the end, Cordelia dies. Lear is totally, he's killed by the soldiers of the evil daughters. She is killed, but Lear is totally unreconciled to her death. And rather than any kind of regeneration or salvation, seeing he does not accept her death. And he says in what is maybe the most, Samuel Johnson, the great Dr. Samuel Johnson, said that this was the most terrible line in literature. He said the death scene was the most terrible scene in all of literature. And the line is, "Thou shalt come no more, never, 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 never." And well, what this shows to me is an important point in all of Shakespeare's, the whole opus of Shakespeare. One of his philosophical obsessions is the nature of time. And time is always irreversible in Shakespeare. That's one of the great lessons of Shakespeare. And this line really shows that more strongly than anything else. So at the end, but Lear is protesting the injustices of Cordelia's death and of the gods in general and his last stage. So he becomes a figure like Prometheus. So what you have there is you have the Yahweh stage of the Godhead, which Jung talks about, and you also have Cordelia at the stage of the wise person, and you have Prometheus is really takes the place of that might be occupied by the devil. Now I'm getting more over into Jung. It's a bit of a different.
Okay, well, if I can jump in here, James, if you don't
yes,
mind.
Thank
you for that summary. And there's, you know, I guess what we can segue where you're going now, and just to make it more explicit about where you segue into, I will read you another quote from your own essay here. And it'll be a great introduction, I think, to where we'll go next in terms of the archetypal stages of transformation that this Lear, the old king, goes through, how that might relate to Jung's book, Answer to Job. You write, "King Lear, I believe, is the most powerful work in Western literature, our paradigmatic tragedy, because it contains our most authentic vision of the four archetypes of the Western Judeo-Christian Godhead, coupled with the most fundamental truth of human existence and possibly of existence itself, the irreversibility of time," which you've mentioned just now. Now, the irreversibility of time is certainly a human truth that I think most of us can relate to, if we take the trouble to let us ourselves feel it. And we'll return to that. But first, maybe you could tell us what you see as the four archetypes of the Western Judeo-Christian Godhead that manifest in King Lear, and perhaps how those also are paralleled in Jung's Answer to Job. What are those four archetypes that you see running throughout these two works of literature?
Well, first there is Yahweh, and Jung talks a great deal about the flaws of Yahweh, how he's unconscious, blind, and needs really to be morally educated. He needs to learn what the lot of man is, and essentially sins against Job by imposing all these tortures upon him, which were invented by Satan. But according to Jung, Yahweh inexplicably takes up Satan on his challenge and lets Job suffer unjustly in order to test his loyalty to Yahweh. So we have a very unjust Yahweh, and Jung sees, as he sees Christianity unfold, he sees Jesus coming not to compensate for or atone for the sins of man against God, but to atone for the sins of God against man, and perhaps more important, to learn what human suffering is, and to gain the moral consciousness of man. So Yahweh, by becoming Jesus, advances God's moral consciousness. So that's really two archetypes of God there, the Father and then essentially the good Son. But usually in mythical stories, there are two sons, Cain and Abel, a good son and a bad or a prodigal son. And one of Jung's concerns throughout all of his writings is he rejects the doctrine of God being the supreme good and being privatio boni, that evil being just a deprivation of good and absent. And he says, no, evil is real in our world, in the human condition, and it's also real within the human psyche and real within God. And so he says that the Christian view of Godhead is, the Orthodox Christian view, is defective in that there's no place for evil, Satan, the material also is classed in that place with Cain. And I think one of the interesting advances of Shakespeare, where he actually goes beyond Jung and reflects maybe an obsession of the Renaissance, is he really puts Prometheus in this place of the opposition to the good son. The bad son is Prometheus, which is in certain respects a positive figure. He opposes God, of course, but he opposes God in order to deliver consciousness to mankind.
So, if James, if I can jump in here again, because there's a lot you're saying, just if I understand you correctly, Job goes through a transformations in this work. He starts off, you are saying, as Yahweh, as a God of emotion, as an inflated person, identified with power, expecting other people to bend to his will. Then he's stripped of his clothing, of his royal privileges. He's reduced to nothing, a theme that we'll come back to, this idea of nothing in the poem, and becomes something like Job, then, the one who's suffering. And then he becomes something like Prometheus, you're saying now, the one who rebels against the injustices of God, sees the human suffering and rebels against God's unjust suffering that he causes. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. At the end of the play, he does become Prometheus. And this is very important because this, in a way, is an advance over Jung, because Jung doesn't focus in on that Promethean archetype the way Shakespeare does. And I think there are three ways of seeing each of these positions could have many different figures associated with them. But the three principal figures in the West would be Satan. And that was the way the medievals liked to look at this figure. Then there's Lucifer, who is mythically, he's Satan before his fall. And then there's Prometheus. So Shakespeare focuses on Prometheus. But there's also a fourth figure in the Godhead. And that figure, Jung also laments the absence of the feminine in the Godhead. He said God must represent wholeness, and he cannot be complete without the feminine. And so he recognized the Sophia figure in the lore surrounding the Bible, and things like the Shekinah were feminine figures, but they were basically initially the Holy Spirit was conceived of as feminine. And we have a clearer statement of that, I think, in the feminist scholars that did work in this area in the 70s and 80s after Jung's death. They did a good job in documenting why this is so, but Jung understood it as well. So the feminine has to be present in the Godhead, if it's a real Godhead, I think it was Jung's view. So he looked, he thought that, well, the Catholics and the elevation of Mary, that was a step in the right direction. He didn't clearly spell out what happened there, which was simply that the theologians of the third century, I think led by Philo Judaeus, just explicitly argued that God cannot have a feminine element, that the Holy Spirit has to be neuter, it can't be feminine, because this would introduce imperfection and evil into God. Now, what Shakespeare does is he identifies, I think, this third figure in the Godhead, or Cordelia represents in King Lear, the fourth figure, which is, you might see her, Cordelia, as like the anima, his vision of the anima of God, so that the fourth figure brings wholeness and completeness. And there are three stages of consciousness. There's the animal immorality. There's the hostile brothers and the opposition, the positing of the conflict of opposites. And then there's a kind of coincidentia oppositorum, a dialectic that brings them together in the highest figure, the highest aspect of the Godhead, which for Shakespeare is Cordelia represents. And she also represents kind of the anima of the Godhead. And the anima is a mediating figure that brings together opposites. Mm. So Jung was struggling for what toward and largely achieved. He was struggling to realize what is most clearly stated in all of our literature in King Lear, is this vision of the four parts: father, the initial parent, the two brothers, and then the anima, who represents the wise person. And that's what we get in King Lear.
Understood. So that's why, in a nutshell, you would suggest people that read King Lear should read Answer to Job, Jung's Answer to Job, and people that read Jung's Answer to Job should read King Lear. And there's a mutual back and forth there that we can learn from, you know, each text something similar, even maybe identical. For instance, as you write, again, I'll quote to you from your article. I want to bring your article in because the language is so beautiful and powerful. You say, as Jung foresaw, a true vision of the Godhead must compensate for the defects of Orthodox theology's Trinity, with its facile exclusion of the feminine and of the shadow material aspects, along with its hollow-hearted solutions to the problems of evil and human suffering, unquote. Which, boy, Aunt Job is certainly a story of the problems of evil and human suffering, as is King Lear.
Help DEA keep our community safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
And as you know, when Pope Pius XII, I think in 1950, declared that the Assumption of Mary is a dogma, that means if you're Catholic, you must believe that Mary has risen into heaven, body and soul, where she effectively, and Jung talks a lot about this, as you know, in Answer to Job, becomes part of the Trinity, you know, transforming it not in the dogma, but in Jung's understanding into a quaternity. Jung was very interested in that development. And that's something you're seeing in King Lear as well, that kind of development, which also includes not just the beautiful, redeemed, pure side of the feminine, like Mother Mary, but also the problems of evil, of suffering, and how evil belongs to the process of transformation. It's something which is powerful for me in King Lear, and I want to talk to you about that. Lear transforms through evil, his own ignorance and his own injustice, and also the evil of his daughters, and being stripped to nothing through his mistakes and through the evil actions of these ingrateful daughters of his that are, as you say, amongst the worst characters in all of literature, Goneril, oh my gosh, because of ingratitude. And he goes through a horror story of suffering, including madness, his own madness. And paradoxically, this is what changes him. And I want to talk to you later about what type of redemption there might be in this play, if any. But just to notice here, the role of evil in the transformation process was something very powerful to me, and something that Jung writes a lot about as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, evil is the experience with, the contention with evil, and suffering is essential in Jung's view of the individuation quest. When we're undergoing this, we're on the way to wholeness. And he sees the individuation and the quest for wholeness as, at one point he says, it's a crucifixion of the ego. And the ego is crucified to become conscious of things that it simply avoids or hasn't experienced. And the objective is wisdom, which is, maybe wisdom is understanding of time. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the view implicit in Shakespeare, the visionary artist. It's understanding. This is something that I've developed in my a little bit in my book on Jung's cartography of the psyche, that time gives value and meaning to things. They're valuable and meaningful because they disappear. And this is an idea I get really from Shakespeare. So in a way, an argument for the existence, or existence isn't a good word, the reality of God is that meaning, we live in a universe where meaning and value are possible. And they're possible because of the nature of time. It's just defined that way. Things appear, they disappear. But I'm getting off from the point.
Well, I mean, this is powerful to hear, especially as I get older. I can relate more to what you're saying about the passage of time and, you know, the meaning that can come through the realization that things don't last forever. Everything changes and we're finite. It's a type of wisdom, I agree with you. And it seems like Lear comes to that realization, but and through, like, as you said, what he says about the death of Cordelia, she's never going to come back. Never, 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 never. That kind of wisdom changes him. But to back up a step, I'm interested in the process by which he changes, by which he gets from the start of the play, where he's this inflated person identified with his own power, totally devoid of self-knowledge, even as one of his daughters says, right, in the play, he hath but slenderly ever known himself, you know.
Yes.
And the process by which he transforms, one of the major themes in this play that you point out in your book in this respect is this theme of nothing. The word nothing echoes throughout King Lear. For instance, Cordelia's nothing precipitates the entire action. Lear says, "What can you say, Cordelia, to draw a third more opulent than your sisters? Speak." "Nothing, my lord." Lear: "Nothing?" Cordelia: "Nothing." Lear: "Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." And that's a theme that, you know, runs throughout. The Fool brings that theme of nothingness up. At some point, Lear says, "Who am I? Can anyone tell me who I am?" He's really reduced to nothing, literally stripped of all his persona and his identification with royalty and power. Now, you write something that really struck me about this teleology, we could say, of nothing, where it's heading, its purpose, right? It's not just a mistake, it has a purpose. It transforms him. And you say, as this relates to our everyday life, something I thought was very powerful. You wrote that pride tells us we are everything. Necessity shows us we are nothing. And in our nothingness, we can discover the truth about ourselves and find compassion for others. That, to me, was a very powerful statement. And I feel it in King Lear, and I can feel it as you've integrated it in your life. I wonder if you have more thoughts about that or anything you'd like to say about that theme in the play and in life.
Well, that's a very difficult concept to get your hands around. It's interesting that thinkers of that time, roughly the late medieval and Renaissance, were the nature of nothingness and the kind of the power of nothingness, you might say, was something that fascinated them. And a great deal was written about that then. I think of it in terms of, if you're reduced to nothingness, what do you have left? You have pure consciousness left. You're not defined by any of these other roles, or you're just a source of consciousness. And with this consciousness that's left, without these defining attributes, you're able to see things as they are. And I also think of physics and the nothingness of space. Space, as we know, isn't nothing. We don't know exactly what it is, but there are all sorts of forces in space, and the speculation is there are creative powers within space. So nothingness is at the core of the human person in the sense that it's consciousness, and nothingness is in also may be at the core of the universe, the space in which it's created. It's a very difficult idea. That
very difficult. That's very profound too, and I think super relevant to, you know, my work as a Jungian analyst, for instance, and seeing the transformation processes that people go through in everyday life. Often, as we know, it's kicked off by some kind of process that's akin to what happens to Lear. A mistake happens. I went through a midlife crisis. I lost the meaning in my life. I've lost my money. I've, you know, succumbed to some kind of depression. Something's happened that stripped me of my persona, my belief in who I thought I was, what was true I thought about life, what I thought were the real values and real goals. And often people transform by being totally stripped of what they thought was true that way. You know, this is the idea of symbolic death. That's the symbol of transformation throughout the world, is die to who you were so you can become something different. It's a horrible process, and it does feel like being reduced to nothing sometimes. I think there's a lot of people that can relate to that idea. And so very meaningful, I think, and to point out like these great works of literature like Lear that show there's actually a process, a meaningful process going on in what looks at the start just like a horror story, just like an accident, just like something without any purpose or meaning. But there's a connection in the play, we could say, between nothingness and self-knowledge. It's one of the things I think you're pointing out here. You know, the famed Irish poet William Butler Yeats said that Shakespeare was a folklorist with a silver tongue, is how he put it. And one of the reasons I think why is because every fairy tale or folk story starts out with something bad happens, something horrible happens. You know, there's no such thing as a fairy tale where the king and queen are happy and they have children and life's great and that's it. There'd be no story. There's always a crisis. There's always a mistake, a slanderer at the king's court. Something goes wrong. They can't have children. They're going to figure out how to have children. They've lost something of incredible value. They're being threatened with destruction, right? Every story starts like that. And without that evil, you could say, there would be no transformation and no story. So that's what it seems to me. One of the powerful things about King Lear, as I said earlier, his own evil at the start, his own ignorance, and then his own lack of self-knowledge, and then the evil acts of his daughters are what initiate him into self-knowledge. You say in your article that suffering and madness have exercised the Yahweh archetype. That was a powerful line, I thought. What has changed Lear? What has exercised his identification with this being God in a power-oriented way? Suffering and madness change him.
Well, I think you've kind of summarized it pretty well. And what you were saying about your patience, Lear, of course, encountering a disaster and then having to reconstruct and finding themselves anew, maybe the greatest story of all of that kind is the story of King Lear.
Well, let's explore that more, because there's a lot there. I mean, for instance, one thing that struck me in the plays at the end, Lear is talking to Cordelia and asking for her forgiveness, as you said, and she says those beautiful lines, no cause, no cause. that just give me chicken skin when I hear that. Yeah. She's such a powerful figure. But then he proposes to Cordelia that they take up the mystery of things. I thought that was very powerful in terms of his transformation too. He's developed compassion and has a sense now of the mystery of things. He goes from certainty to the unknown to appreciation for mystery.
I think those are incredibly beautiful lines. And part of the mystery of things is that it's a sense of awe and acceptance too, I suppose. But because it is a mystery, because things, the way reality is, that the fact that there is anything at all, it's a mystery. And so we can't really go on to define that into some simple formula. We kind of have to leave it there.
Yeah, real nicely said. That's beautifully said. That's an apex of wisdom, you could say, rather than knowledge, is an appreciation for the we don't know. There's a lot we don't know.
Yes.
And that's coming out of inflation and opening up to something bigger than our ego is partly what happens to Lear, I guess.
Yeah. And in terms of Shakespeare's development, it's interesting that you have King Lear, and it raises certain questions and certain issues. And then you go on to other plays that don't really have much to do with those, like Antony and Cleopatra or Coriolanus. But at the very end, The Tempest, he takes up some of these things again and presents a figure who is kind of like a male version of Cordelia, but one who survived. Cordelia didn't survive. He's gone through all of these things, and then he's an old man, of course, and he's a magician. So he represents magic, and there's all sorts of stuff from Giordano Bruno and drawn in there. But he represents, he's able to articulate more what Jung called the wise old man archetype. And someone who's achieved, who's gone through suffering and achieved individuation and lived into old age. And he has a daughter too. And he marries her to a prince who lands on the island, and everything ends happily. But it's in a way a very satisfying solution to some of the things that are left over at the end of King Lear. It shows a similar thing where Prospero is also deposed by his brother, as Lear was deposed by the daughters, and shows them in a way that has a happy ending. So I think with King Lear and the Tempest, he shows, yes, this is a world in which terrible disasters happen, and they don't always end happily. We can't be guaranteed any kind of happy ending. Thou come no more, never, 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 never. But it's also a world where sometimes things can end quite happily. Hmm. And to some extent, at least, it's up to us where we end up.
Hmm. Beautifully said. Yeah, and I agree with you. The genius of Shakespeare for me does include what you mentioned earlier, his expansive ability to generate an expressions of the totality of human nature. I mean, in all respects, light, dark, comedy, tragedy. When I was in college, I did a summer semester at Oxford, and one of our classes was on Shakespeare, and we went to see just six Shakespeare plays at the Barbican and at the Globe, and everyone loved them because there's something for everyone in these plays, from fart jokes to the lowest of low to the highest poetry, to these huge archetypal dimensions that we're bringing out today, and just the everyday human experience. So I want to just put an exclamation point on that vis-a-vis Shakespeare, for sure.
And Harold Bloom, maybe the most famous critic of our period of time, said that Shakespeare invented the human, and by that I mean, I think he meant that he showed all aspects of what it was to be human. But in a way, we talked about rebooting Christianity. A lot of people talk about that nowadays. And what I would have to say about that is, if you're going to reboot Christianity, maybe you should set the Bible on a shelf and your number one book for telling, understanding man and God in the Western God and so on is actually the works of Shakespeare.
It's amazing, James.
Not the Bible.
That's really, really something. It reminds me of a friend of mine, I won't say who it is, but who was going through a really severe crisis at one point in his life. And he told me during this time he had lost a lot. I won't get into the personal details, but he was really being crushed by life. And he said, during that whole time, I just kept The Tempest by my bedside. And that was the book I read the whole way through. So I hear you here. This is the importance and value of Shakespeare that you are getting to, that it's pretty, pretty incredible. It's exciting to hear, and it's profound.
Yeah, and we've had these periods where there was a period in the West that maybe began with Socrates and moved on through and ended in with the writing of the Gospels, and a kind of revelatory of things about what it is to be human, what it is to be human living in this sphere in which we live. Then we had another period which incorporated all those things and in a way moved beyond the flaws in them. And you have to consider the context of Shakespeare. It was also the time, roughly, of Michelangelo and Leonardo and Kepler and Copernicus and Francis Bacon and Cervantes writing Don Quixote, and a tremendous kind of dynamism there, of which probably the supreme jewel in all of those things is the works of Shakespeare.
Mm. Thank you for that, the context of the spirit of the times. And maybe we can move on to this connection with the human. You know, Shakespeare is the inventor of the human. Now, you as a human, you are a human, and you're an interesting human, and you've had a very interesting career as far as, like, the little bit that I know of it, in terms of being an AIDS activist in Washington, D.C., an FDA activist. And my understanding is that your work, especially with AIDS, resulted in the speeding up of certain drugs to the public that saved thousands and thousands of lives. And, you know, you're a person evidently who has been face to face with suffering and, you know, ameliorating suffering to the extent you can. So I kind of am curious into how your work with Shakespeare and your work with literature relates to your work on the ground. For instance, here's another profound line in your article, one that struck me. You write that, quote, "Where men lack justice, they lack dignity. Whatever threatens belief in ultimate justice can menace sanity," which, of course, you're talking about Lear, but you're talking about human life. So in Lear, speaking of his ungrateful daughters, Lear explodes at one time in the play. He says, "No, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall. I will do such things, what they are, yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or error I'll weep. Oh, fool, I shall go mad." Wow. Powerful lines of suffering, weeping, madness, you know, justice. So I'm wondering, can you say something about our emotional need for justice within society, and how intensely painful it can be for everyday people to go through this experience of the implacable facts of life, time's brutal irreversibility, and what might help, or what has helped, in your experience, in your work, and in your life, that you can see in King Lear, in terms of this, you see a lot of archetypal meaning in the story, and I'm wondering how those two might go together for you in your work and your personal life, if you might say something about that.
Well, I think if you experience an injustice, the temptation is there to just ignore it, push it aside, accept it. I think early on, I was dealing with the problem of evil. This was when I was in Jungian analysis, and I was only maybe 30 years old or so. And I thought a great deal about the problem of evil. And but the conclusion I thought that was something, I found it as being implicit in Jung, not really spelled out, but implicit. And that was evil and injustice. Of course, injustice is one of the great evils. It's the most painful and most difficult evil because it's an evil deliberately inflicted by society or other people, whereas if you get cancer, that's a bad part of the universe, you might say. But injustice is harder to deal with than cancer, I think. I've not had cancer, but I've had very unpleasant health problems. So I think evil is a challenge to create new good. And the same is for injustice. It's a challenge to create new good within society. And part of that good, of course, is expansion of consciousness. It's an understanding of things you didn't understand before and bringing them to consciousness. That's a big part of dispelling evil. You make it conscious. You understand it.
Nice. Well, let me quote back to you again something from your book in this respect that I thought that was very moving to me. You talk about the archetypal patterns and symbols behind Cordelia, Lear, and their story that penetrate the deepest reaches of our souls. They convey an authentic religious vision that gives singularly profound and disturbing meaning to events that seem realistically proclaim only a meaningless doom. Wow, that really struck a big chord in my soul when I read that. There's something going on in these great works of literature that penetrate deeper down beneath our ordinary experience of suffering and injustice, and that's to say something true to us that we can lose if we stay on the surface. And I think that's a very profound thing to usher forth and to be able to see in these works of genius, that they speak truths that apply to all of us. They're not just fantasies. They really are saying what's real deeper down that we might not be aware of. In this respect, I'd like to get your thoughts on what I consider to be the redemption, if there is one, in King Lear. Of course, Cordelia dies and there's the tragedy and this, she's never coming back again. And he's filled with suffering and grief at the end of the play. But he is changed. He has gone from, I mean, let's just say it bluntly, he was an asshole. He was a power mad jerk. He was inflated. He would just exercise his will over everyone. He had no compassion, no relatedness. And through his extreme suffering and humiliation is also a word that comes to mind here, humiliation, even the verge of madness. I'm not going to weep. I'll go mad instead of weeping. Even through all that, he becomes different. He becomes a person that does have compassion again, can relate to Cordelia, has more self-knowledge, is exploring the mystery of things, and can grieve. So here's what you said about Cordelia's truth. And I'd like to maybe end with this and get your thoughts, because this really struck me. Here's what you say. Her Cordelia's truth, by recognizing evil without flinching, makes redemption from inauthenticity possible. Wow. The redemption from inauthenticity
and
is possible.
That's the redemption of the lies and we tell ourselves and the evasions we resort to. I think there's a reaching down to the archetypes. And that's a word that, well, to me, I think technically an archetype is like, Jung stresses that it's a psychic reality. It's not an idea or a concept. It's a way pattern which things follow. And I kind of think of it as being maybe like a field. You know, we have electric gravity field, electromagnetic field, and so on. And there's something very fundamental about these things. The fields in physics are very fundamental, it would appear. And they're very fundamental. So you reach down and somehow you find what's fundamental and you find it feelingly. That's an important thing in King Lear, where the character says, "I see it feelingly."
Beautiful, yes.
Which he didn't before. And if you just understand something intellectually, you don't understand it in the whole. You have to understand it feelingly. And that's a way of achieving authenticity, to understand things feelingly. I don't know whether this answers your point.
I think completely on point for me. Beautifully said. Thank you for bringing that in about "I see things feelingly" in the poem. That was a beautiful line in the play itself, too.
Yes. There's so many fabulous lines in the play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and obviously so much more we could say, so much more that has been said, so many of your books that you have written on Shakespeare. But I'm glad we could at least scratch the surface here in our conversation today. It's been wonderful talking with you about some of the big themes in your writing. And I really appreciate you talking with us, James. And thank you.
Thank you for all of your excellent points and questions and for your very careful and thoughtful reading of my work, Tom.
My pleasure. My honor. My pleasure. I look forward to reading more of your books. And I hope the audience will know they're out there, too. And if they enjoyed this conversation, there's a lot more they can do to find you in terms of your written, your extensive book collection that you compiled, especially in these last 7 years. You've been very prolific. So, again, thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, too, Tom.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth. Jungian Perspectives is presented by the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles and the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California. New episodes post monthly. Please visit our website, jungianperspectives.com, to learn more about upcoming episodes and look for us on YouTube and Spotify. We are a project of the journal Psychological Perspectives. To access the journal online at a preferential rate of $37 per year, please contact societies@tnf.co.uk. To subscribe to both the print and digital versions of the journal at a discounted rate of $85 per year, four issues, please go to junginla.org/media/psychological-perspectives. Jungian Perspectives is hosted by Tom Elsner, edited by Rick Such at Earshot Audio Post, and narrated by Kirsten Kairos. Funding made possible by Earthways Foundation, promoting a vision for the future that all living things can share.